Welcome, 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 everyone. I am so thrilled that everyone is here. I'm so thrilled that so many people came to support Patrick, his family and loved ones and friends. Thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the Greater Boston Zen Center. The morning is going to take place in three parts. The third part is refreshments and pie. The first part is I have asked Patrick to give a little talk about kind of what this means, this whole bizarre Zen ordination thing with the strange garments and the bald heads and whatnot. And he has graciously agreed to do so. For the Sangha members of the Greater Boston Zen Center who may not know Patrick, Patrick practiced with us for many years when we were in Boston at our Ralph Waldo Emerson Sangha, and has since moved to North Carolina. He is a neurosurgeon, and he teaches in the medical school down there. He is also a robotics researcher and a extremely lovely human being. really loved that wave of assent that just came forth. That was fantastic. You know, and in a certain way, we say that all of our ceremonies, all of these ceremonial acknowledgments take place after the fact. So in a really important way, nothing changes with this. And that just sound of affirmation and assent of Patrick's heart that you just heard, that is in a certain way pointing to why this ceremony is important, to acknowledge that. Patrick will speak a little bit about how the one that you all know and love is actually one deeply touched and moved by the teachings of Zen Buddhism already. And so on one hand, nothing at all changes. And on another hand, it is important to mark these. There is a power in public affirmation. There is a power in coming forth and saying, yes, this is a part of who I am. And so that will also be part of what's going on here. So the first part will be Patrick's talk. Then there will be another break of a few minutes as we get a few less things in place for the actual ceremony. And then we will do the ceremony and eat some pie.
I know that looks like a lot of paper. I'm not going to talk that long.
Thank you, Josh. And thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you for making it all the way from California, from Colorado, from up the street. I really...
From North Carolina.
From North Carolina. Yeah, I can't say that I was expecting ever to be sitting here giving this talk, but it's a great pleasure to be able to do so. Thank you. So I am going to start the talk actually with a koan. And for those who aren't familiar with what that is, a koan is really, there are many forms that koans take. The form that we'll be looking at today is a kind of a story or a verse. And these verses are really perspectives on our human life and how that life interfaces with our world and really interweaves in our lives in the universe. You'll get a sense for it. But this is from the Mumon Khan, which is the Gateless Gate, one of the many collections of these types of koans, and this is K16. It's Yunmen's The Sound of the Bell. the case. Yunmen said, "How vast and wide the world is. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell?" Now, you see a lot of robes here today, and you yourself put on a lot of robes in your day, that not necessarily having seven pieces, but I want to take you back a little bit to when I to how I got here, and really it interfaces with my work as a neurosurgeon. When I first entered neurosurgery, I was a medical student who, quite academically driven and getting all the academics, looking for the academic successes and the big wins, and I was like, oh, this is going to be the next step, I'll become a neurosurgeon, and I had absolutely no idea what I was about ready to walk into. I had no idea that it was going to, the depth to which, and the demands and the encounters that I would have, not as this academic neurosurgeon, but as actually a physician put on the front lines of human suffering. And that was something that I was never prepared for at all, even in medical school, even in our sort of mock classes and little seminars, that does nothing to prepare you for when you actually are sitting in that cold room with the fluorescent lighting and the half box of Kleenex, talking to a family at 3 a.m. whose loved one just was brought in brain dead after a large hemorrhage. And you even as an intern and as a resident, I rapidly found myself encountering these very difficult scenarios, really with seemingly no guidance from my superiors or my seniors on how to approach this. And it manifested more and more throughout that training. I have examples that can go on for hours. I won't spare you, but just to show you sort of the things we come to. As an intern, for instance, I remember walking, it was probably 10 o'clock at night, I was walking up on the wards, I was on a neurology service, and I remember stopping outside the room because I heard this old woman crying from her bed, and it was this 80-year-old woman who had had a stroke, and she was laying there in her bed at 11 p.m. at night with really no family. I don't think she had any family at the time. And she was crying there for her mother, yelling out into the hallways of the hospital overnight. And to watch that of happening and to try to comfort her in this dazed and sort of demented state while at this twilight of her life as she was transitioning to death, and watching her cry out for her mother for help was an incredibly disheartening and disorienting experience. And this is one element that comes up, the travesties and the traumas that arise that we saw in not only our care of patients on the floor, but the traumas that would come in, the patients with brain tumors or bad hemorrhages into their brain. It really is an endless stream of tragedy. And also an invitation. And that was the part that I really, during the shock of all of this, as I was immersing myself within my neurosurgical training, what really started to become my touchstone was my Zen practice. Because I had been practicing for probably about 9 years then, and what I found is that that arising of disorientation, of fear, of hurt, of aversion, that was coming up in my mind as I faced the suffering that was so vividly put into my face during my clinical practice, these were the same things that were rising for me on the cushion in my meditative practice. And they became interweaved. That the ability to, as we sit here in Zazen and Shikantaza, seeing what comes up for us and letting it go, these was the same turning towards that I was seeing in the hospital. That as when the suffering and the pain was coming up, instead of recognizing the aversion that would come to it and letting that aversion go and letting the grief and the suffering be what it is. And what I found through that practice as I went through my residency training and was that practice of being present with the suffering that as it arose, the allowing it to be what it is, to provide the comfort where I could, but also seeing in what arose for me in those moments too, really was a gateway for me to be more compassionate for my patients. Because amidst that, all of those tragedies, it became a mirror back to my own mortality and my own unknowing in this world. And I have taken care of patients and have many patients that have had hemorrhages or brain tumors that have slowly picked off aspects of who they, this fortress of self that has been constructed for who they were. I've watched their memories disappear, their ability to recognize faces, their ability to speak or move their arms or legs, the ideas of morality, what's normal or what's not normal, all of these things that we sort of construct around our idea of who we are, I've seen those taken away one by one. And and while I have watched it, it also reflects back to me, and I have to ask myself, like, am I also like this? Is this me too? Is this where it's going to happen to me? Yes. but it was really, these interactions then were a gateway, because as I took care of these patients and their family members with these terrible, devastating things happening and watched their shifting concept of who they were, where this fixed idea of who they were slowly release and change into something different, I saw myself changing in the way that I could understand who I was. And by doing that, it really for me opened a way to be compassionate in those moments, because it was no longer me sitting in that dingy little room with the half-used box of Kleenex and the devastated family, me wearing the white coat sitting in the chair and this family member's crying. It was just human beings sitting there amidst the suffering that was coming up in that moment. And the ability to then sit there and allow that to be what it is and to not try and fix it. That grief and that pain that was arising is exactly what is happening in that moment. And that has, for both my own healing in approaching the situations and I think the healing of the families that I've taken care of, it's been a grateful interaction. Because they have the space then, and we all have the space to be with that impermanence of our own existence. When I was finishing up residency, as I was kind of traveling through this, I really, and as my Zen practice matured in tandem with this, and I sort of, they became one and the same, and I like to think of it as I have a clinical practice and I have a Zen practice, but it's all a practice. But as that concluded, I also saw, this was not my own experience, of course. I have my intern colleagues, my co-residents, my fellow faculty members, the senior faculty members, all of us facing these same things over and over again. And in my own field, it's really something, this idea of approaching suffering and turning toward the pain that we're seeing and using that as an invitation to be compassionate is not at all found in my field. And you would think it would be quite the opposite, that if we went through, you have physicians that are trained to be, you want your doctor when you go into the emergency room to be this compassionate person who's there to care for you on a level, to really be there for you on multiple fronts. I found that wasn't the case in my field. And perhaps it was historical, because in neurosurgery, when it first started, the mortality was so high that I think those that stayed in the field were those that could shut off that pain and turn away. And then that historical training and sort of momentum stayed within our field. But that's not okay. And what I've seen is my colleagues struggling with the same sort of traumas that I struggled with going through residency. Not knowing who to talk to. I've bumped into my co-residents in stairwells crying to themselves, sitting in their cars before they go home, just with their head in their hands, trying to get a little breath of fresh air before they plunge back into what our normal life outside the hospital is. And that there was a need there to be able to help my colleagues in that environment maybe turn a little bit toward this pain and the suffering that's going on. And so when I went down to Duke to start my clinical practice, I've also simultaneously tried to build my Zen presence and Zen practice in that environment. I have a group that I meet with every month of residents and student doctors and really anybody who wants to show up to have an open dialogue and space to approach these problems. And it sounds kind of obvious for those who probably are here thinking about that. It is not at all in our environment. You can go to our conferences, our national conferences, and you'll see an infinite number of talks on how to clip this aneurysm or dissect this particular vessel or get this particular tumor out, and absolutely nothing on how to take care of patients who are actually suffering and how to approach that suffering in yourself that comes up and the stress that arises from that, even though you have a room of literally 1,000 neurosurgeons doing this every single day. So what I've tried to do at Duke then is to create that space. And I started a group that I initially called Encountering Suffering. That was the title I gave the hour-long discussion or space I had. That even was a little too risque for the neurosurgical community. And so it kind of morphed into the more medically sterile title of Difficult Case Conference. So that's what I now run, is the Difficult Case Conference. It looks better in the emails on the weekend. And really what it has been is just I sit there and just allow what comes up to come up in the room and whoever walks through the door. I was, the first time I did it, I fully expected to be sitting in an empty room for an hour. But that was absolutely not the case. The entire residency showed up. They walked in, and not everyone spoke because it wasn't the moment for them, or it wasn't the what was seemed like the best path for them. But they were there in affirmation of these difficult things that have been encountered, and I have been amazed at what has come up then just by creating that space and how much there is simmering underneath a hurt within the providers that has been unaddressed. Yeah, the first time we sat down, one of the interns, literally the first thing out of her mouth, there was just space before that. She said, "I declared 3 people dead last night." And I just wait and let that go from there. And even if, again, we don't try to fix those things, there's nothing to be fixed. It is what has happened and what is there for us in those moments. But it goes beyond just the sort of the death and destruction part, but actually also what's coming up for them as physicians. One of the other residents, first thing that they said was, "I'm really, really angry at the patients." And I just pause and let that go. I said, "What's happened for me is I'm furious at them for making me have to do for one more thing I have to do, for getting sick so that then I have to spend 30 more minutes in the hospital, which means I don't get to put my children to bed, which means I don't get to eat dinner. I haven't been able to sleep. I'm just angry at them for getting sick." And that too is what's coming up for him right then. And it's a shared experience too, because you see this happening with our other providers, with myself too, when I was resident in those places. And so we've created this space to be able to turn toward some of these are things that come up for us. And really it's my practice and my community that I'm serving is within that environment of the hospital as a neurosurgeon. But these are the things that come up for all of us in our lives. Like when outside the walls of that little place, the grief, the anger, the aversion, in the travesties that we see in our own world, whether they're in the small griefs or large ones within our own lives or that we see in the news or in the world around us, as we turn our ears toward the suffering of the world, it's hard to see, we see those things arise for us. The aversion to these these events or the anger surrounding certain things. And it's just that turning towards. That's all you need to do. One of the practices that's the hardest things, I think, for in our particular neurosurgical world is that we are often called upon to make very particular decisions, very analytical, fast decisions. I can give you an example. I spent a brief time in Uganda and Mumbrara, which is this little town in the western side of the country. And they have there's a lot of head trauma that comes through there. There's motorcycles everywhere, no road rules, no one wears a helmet. And as a result, there's a lot of trauma. And we had two patients actually come in who were riding on the same motorcycle. They were hit by a car, both simultaneously. Both hit their head, both had a catastrophic hemorrhage into their brain, and they were both wheeled into the stretchers at the same time. And both of them needed a surgery. And there's one operating room. So there was in the emergency room of this emergency room is a room off the street where they handle emergencies. And these two patients rolled up, and we have one OR. And so I had to decide, this person looks a little more dead than the other one. We won't take them to the OR. This one goes upstairs. And that was it. And that person died in the hallway. This person we took up to the OR, and they died later that night. We were faced with decisions that we have to make in a very analytical way based on the data that we have. But that the resonance of that decision-making comes up for me as a great deal of guilt fear about making the wrong decision. Guilt that I didn't, that maybe I made, maybe if I had chosen him, he would have survived and that they would have died anyways. But these are the things that have come up in these scenarios. And part of my practice with my residents and my teams is to know that that's unfortunate, that's part of what we've been called on to do, is to make those decisions. And to be able to recognize that there are times when we turn our heart wide open to the suffering that we're experiencing and we break along with the patient and their family. And then there are other times when we have to turn away, that we have to make a decision on their behalf or on our own behalf, without feeling completely broken by what we're seeing. And this coming and going, this turning towards in a way, is a natural breathing part of our practice. And I think this goes to really what I think always echoes in my mind from what Josh has told me, is that even in our own lives when we're doing things, sometimes we feel more open and we feel less open. And this is okay. This is doing what we can when we can in the amount we can. And this is something that I really have worked with our residents to do, because they too feel this guilt that maybe they could have done more or that they made the wrong decision, and to be with knowing that there is this dynamic nature of the practice that we have has been, I think, really empowering for them. And it really comes, I think, in general, this work is in its infancy, and as is all of our practice, and we just continue to work and continue to be present with these things. And really, for me and for, I think, everyone in this room, this is really the Bodhisattva path. This is the path of one who takes this practice and their compassion and tries to help others amidst the suffering. I do that. My community and those who I serve are within my neurosurgical community and the world at large. But this is the path that I've seen to be able to help those who might be able to benefit from having this someone, an ear, if nothing else, to be present to what's coming up for them. My hope is that at some point that it will build beyond what it is now in neurosurgery, which is zero. Maybe now not zero. Maybe it's like 0.01 now that we're doing something about it too. There is an invitation there for me to continue to practice in that way. Often my 7-piece robe is a set of scrubs or a white coat. But really, for all of us, it's you it is really the invitation to be the bodhisattva, to be that compassionate person reaching out to the world to help in the midst of suffering. So my fellow bodhisattvas, the world is wide and vast. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell?
Thank you, Patrick. So one way the ordination ceremony we're about to see is sometimes described is as a bodhisattva ordination, an affirmation of one's commitment to live this life in this way that Patrick has so vividly described. One way that Zen sometimes talks about itself is having to do with the great matter. And the great matter truly is this matter of life and death. This inclusive one thing that is life and death together. And the heartbreak and joy together that comes with this difficult path of being a human being, of suffering from the medical condition that is actually surprisingly common. It's known as being human. And it actually has 100% fatality rate. There is a larger whole. There is a larger whole that is the universe of life and death, the ocean of wisdom and compassion, and all of us rising and falling as waves. I'm so grateful to Patrick for many reasons, but one is that when I have difficult days, one of my day jobs is I'm a book editor. Sometimes an author whose book I'm editing might be angry at me, and sometimes I might leave a typo in a book that I should have fixed before it goes to press. And sometimes these things are hard for me, and then I remember Patrick's life, and I'm like, right, thank you for that reorientation. So I find the fact of Patrick's existence very orienting and grounding in my own life.
I saw a period was missing on that other book.
So soon we will hear a number of sounds of the bell, and Patrick will put on for the first time a particular kind of seven-piece robe, and I hope that you all may have a little bit more of a sense of what that means to him to be doing.